On this week's 51%, we meet a woman veteran who turned to writing to process her experience abroad and upon return.
I think the biggest thing was not being recognized as a female combat veteran. Asked if I was a wife or a girlfriend or here with someone else or here with my dad.
Then we meet a woman trying to nurture her art while being homeless. And we hear about a time when Donald Trump had a cosmopolitan invitation. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Know that a woman's strong. Some say she don't belong, but she refused to listen. She serves the country with pride, standing at attention. People saying they don't belong in the battlefield, so they work hard and fight hard in the battlefield. She ain't afraid to die, she ain't afraid to serve. It's about time they get the props that they deserve. Cause when the country calls, yeah, there they are. I know some women with purple hearts and bronze stars. For the women fought and died for this country. For the ones who still alive fighting hard for this country. Keep your head up, stay proud and do what you do. I'll be here fighting this war right next to you.
Yeah. Jenny Pakanowski is an Iraq combat veteran. She's also a writer. I recently met her at a veteran art showcase at the FDR Presidential Library and Museum in Hyde Park, New York. She was part of the program reading her poetry, and she facilitated a warrior writer's workshop.
Within my fierce defensiveness, I covered my heart in barbed wire, closing the gates, released the hounds, allowing their echo to vibrate into souls of men. Now these men just think I'm angry, I'm unruly, or I'm unmanageable. I'm potent. I infiltrated their military, excelled in this rite of passage into manhood. My first sign of proof began when the command sergeant major of my entire battalion spoke to me. I was just a private, a PV2 to be
exact. Pakanowski says her goal is to help veterans and civilians by healing the wounds of war and military culture through the arts. She hopes that creating smoother reintegration programs will keep veterans from paths that lead to suicide, addiction, and homelessness.
I served from 2003 till 2008. 4 years active duty and then 4 years reserves.
So coming at this from a veteran art showcase, obviously this is a way for expression.
Mm-hmm.
And from your perspective, I know you write.
Yes.
And that's your former. And why did you feel the need? How did you discover that or get into that when you came back from service?
I was lucky enough to happen to get invited to a veteran artist retreat. Which I didn't want to go to at all. My mother kind of pushed me and was like, I thought this would be a really good idea for you to do. So I went, and I went to a writing workshop, my very first one, and the facilitator asked me, what do you think, or what do you feel, or about the war, or about coming home, and I hadn't talked about it to anyone, except like my VA provider or whatever, and so she asked me, and initially a lot came out was rage and anger about my the way I got out of the active duty and just coming home and not really having any services as a woman and not really fitting in at the VA, not feeling that my providers were giving me the care that I needed, but I didn't really know what I needed in their defense. So
when you say as a woman, do you feel that as a man you would have had the services you needed?
I think that the services were limited at the time for everyone, but specifically it was difficult to navigate as a woman with the continual like glaring and not being recognized. I think the biggest thing was not being recognized as a female combat veteran. Asked if I was a wife or a girlfriend or here with someone else or here with my dad. And my dad was actually the one that was taking care of me, not the other way around. He is also a veteran. So that was a struggle. I got so angry, I tattooed it on myself.
That's rage.
Yeah, so there it is.
Stop asking me.
Yeah, I should have got it on my forehead. The arm thing didn't help, really. But then that also gave me a jump-off point to start doing educational service, military cultural competency, just helping civilians understand veterans more easily without asking them questions like if they killed someone or if Iraq was hot or if they're Afghanistan mountains and, you know, various things like that. Just trying to, now that I can handle it better, trying to educate civilians culturally, because we have a military culture and we have a civilian culture, and how do we talk to each other?
How does it intersect? How has the writing helped you?
I don't think I would be alive if I didn't have the writing. I facilitate writing workshops for veterans now, so that's given me a lot of purpose, but also just not having to carry everything that I feel and I think in my heart and in my mind and in my body. You know, your body remembers also.
It's one thing to write and have whatever that is for you, be it catharsis, be it relief, whatever it is. And it's another thing to present it in front of people. And so how does that take to another level? What does that do for you?
So I'm really direct, and I have a very specific way of writing, which goes more towards spoken word than it actually goes to being a writer or a poet. Because I'm much more performance, I guess. So it goes back to, I did some research, and I think it goes back to rituals of warriors coming home. The Native Americans had a storytelling process, a cleansing process, so many different things to do for themselves to reconnect to their own bodies and also to reconnect with their community, called sharing the burden. So essentially, when I share with the community or I share with other veterans, we're all carrying it together now instead of just by ourselves. And I can physically, energetically feel that because I'm an empath, so.
Are there pieces of your writing, or is there something where you can't go back to? You did it. It had its effect. You got it out there. You got it out of yourself. You dealt with whatever you had to deal with through that piece of writing. Are there pieces of that for you, or is everything on the table still for sharing?
That's a very good question. Finished pieces are always on the table, but I'm always working, you know. But in the same grain, I have many finished pieces, but I have made a prototype for a book, but I have not yet published it. Or it seems like something about them all together is very frightening to me. Presenting them individually. Performance is very different from publication, I found out. I mean, and some of them are here and there, but like all of them together in that one book, I guess that's the way how I can relate to that question.
It's ready for publication. Yeah. You're not ready for publication.
And I can always find another job or a gig or a speaking event to distract me long enough.
We can always put off what we don't want to do. But do you meet, I'm assuming you do, but I'm make no assumptions, that you meet other women in these workshops on writing, and how has that been to have that camaraderie with another woman? Or is gender unimportant when it comes to the writing?
In the beginning, a lot of the workshops that I facilitated were primarily men, and I would be the only woman in the room again. So I started a female veteran writing group where I live in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. So I'm always happy to meet female veterans, and I'm always excited when they come out or when they identify, because so often female veterans have experienced what I've experienced, like the services weren't there, or they don't feel comfortable in a room with male veterans, or whatever the story is, their truth. So when I started creating more female veteran spaces, you know, more would come.
When did you do this, the one that you formed just for women?
A couple months ago.
So have you had a chance to kind of dissect it and see if there's a difference among your predominantly male writing groups versus, obviously they feel less inhibited.
Yeah, the female veterans are more apt to write about what's going on now. And I find that my male veterans are much more apt to tell their military stories, go into war stories, and then they'll develop into writing about other things. But the women will almost right off the bat go to like, what happened today? What happened, last week or whatever? And then it's kind of like pulling out their military stories because so much of them have put it in the past and just don't want to talk about it anymore for trauma reasons or because there's nothing to tell or they think there's nothing to tell.
Do you see yourself connected with this for the foreseeable future?
Oh yeah, probably for the rest of my life. And then adding to it, I'm going to a facilitator training for Bedlam Outreach to teach acting, Shakespeare acting to veterans.
Jenny, aren't you among the first combat veterans? women combat veterans?
Yeah, it's a, that's a complicated question.
How so?
The Molly Pitchers, have you ever heard of that story? And they would go up to the front lines of the Civil War, and then when the men would fall, they would pull up the rifles. And then my friend Sarah, she was in Mogadishu in Somalia, and she was on the front lines doing convoys. We're just a secret. We've been a secret all these years. So I have no combat medals. I have none of that.
So?
Well, they never recognized the fact that I was in these convoys and on the front lines, and I was a combat medic. And that happened to many of the women in my unit.
So are you saying
that... They gave a Silver Star to my first sergeant, who was a man, who did nothing. Just note that.
I'm sure it's in one of those.
Not yet. I haven't written about him yet.
Really?
Yeah, because I don't want to give him any more space than he's already taken. From women.
Okay. So here we are at a show about women's issues. I mean, is there something to say about the state of affairs for female veterans?
We're building
it. Or female military, you know? I mean,
We're building it, and we're building it for ourselves, by ourselves, you know, and reaching out to communities and being like, hey, we're here. We need services. We need this. So, you know, the VA has come a little bit. We've women health services a little bit. They're totally behind on any kind of OBGYN things. You have to go outside the VA to have a baby. It's very complicated process to have a baby as a veteran through the VA. Unless you have private care, then you're super lucky. So it's just strides, and it's like just finding each other and building together is what I found is the best thing for female military members and veterans to do, because we have each other and we know that.
This is so open-ended, and I usually don't do this, but is there anything else you'd like to say? Because I know that, or you think it's important to get out there in our short time here.
Usually what I just request from civilians is showing up, being a witness, supporting is listening. This stuff is not easy to hear, but needs to be heard, and it's really nice to have a full room instead of, as grateful as I am that the 10 people were here to listen to our words, it dismays me that it's not more, and people want to say thank you for your service and we support the troops, but then they don't show up or witness us when we come home and we would like to tell them something to share the burden. And in that desert, my humanity dried up. My civility, my femininity evaporated in that hot Iraq sun. And I believe that I lived because of it. Or at least, the letters MST, military sexual trauma, do not follow my PTSD.
That was Jenny Pakanowski, an Iraq combat veteran. She speaks about veterans' issues through her poetry and performance and facilitates warrior writers' workshops. Most Skid Rows in America feel like someplace you don't want to be. They're in gritty neighborhoods, people live under tarps and in tents, and belongings are pushed into overstuffed bags. But as Michael Ratcliffe found, sometimes you find a place where something beautiful is nourished, though it might be short-lived.
When I first met Juanita, she was pulling her hair back tightly, revealing a kind, welcoming smile. In her hand, a colored pencil was gliding across a sheet of paper.
And I think I was drawing somewhere around the time I learned how to run, maybe.
She was drawing vivid pictures of African queens wrapped in the fires of the phoenix, red flames and feathers swirling up around her and off the page.
Sometimes I'll go into my own imagination, but I'm really, I don't know, I just appreciate what I see around me, you know?
I asked her to pull out some more of her work. She showed me beautiful colored pencil drawings of zebras, giraffes, and tigers. Other pictures showed tango and belly dancers.
I think I did my first portrait of another human being. I was, maybe 7, 8 years old. I don't have the patience for oil. No, but I do love color pencil, ink, and acrylic.
She'll buy the cheap stuff. And if you've seen her work, you would think that that work was done with expensive material.
That's Juanita's neighbor.
I'm Harvey. I'm homeless. Plain and simple.
He lives around the corner on the same block.
But she has a wonderful eye, though. A wonderful eye. She can really draw and bring a picture to life.
A normal day for Juanita begins at about 4:30 in the morning.
I get up and, of course, take care of my hygiene part and start packing my belongings up inside my tent so that I can have it be seen down and at least taken down by 6 in the morning. And I used to go to Starbucks, have some coffee, and do my artwork over there. Kind of a chance to be away from, you know, just try to ignore the fact that I sleep on the street.
But when you live on the street, you can't count on normal days like that. When I came back a week later, Juanita was gone. Her tent, her clothes, her pencils, all of it had vanished. But I was able to find Harvey.
What happened to Juanita? She went to jail, and I don't know why, but I know she opened.
He told me that the police had come early in the morning as everyone was cleaning up. It was do that or get a ticket. They told her to go faster. She got upset with how they were treating her, and they took her in. Juanita called me back the next week. She'd been released. But the police had taken all of her belongings to a warehouse 5 blocks away.
They take everything, all your property. They know you need your things to survive. You can't not have a blanket.
She said she felt gross. No way to clean herself.
Right now, I'm telling you, I feel like really grimy. You know, you just have your own habits.
She pulled her hair back again tightly and secured it with a hair tie that she had bartered a cigarette for. Then we walked the 5 blocks to the warehouse. The warehouse stood with corrugated metal walls in the middle of a crowded parking lot. The walls looked like they hadn't been painted in 20 years. We got there at 12:30 and were greeted by a bare white sign. It said the warehouse was open just 20 hours a week, and today it closed at 1. It was 12:30, but the place looked dead. She dialed a number on the white sign, but no answer. An hour passed, and no one showed. She called again.
I've been waiting. It was like 12:30 or something around there. I know that, but I've been standing out here waiting for somebody to come since 12:30.
You're gonna have to come back tomorrow. Tomorrow's Thursday. They open from
8 to 1. I got that point. So why is it that you guys say somebody's coming and nobody shows up? That's what I want to know. Last time it took me 5 times to get my stuff. You get here, call the number, you might get somebody, you might not. Deal with attitude, I don't know. Why do you answer this number if you don't know? Well, tell me. It doesn't make no sense.
A few months ago, a federal judge ruled that the city of Los Angeles can't destroy a homeless person's property without warning. Stuff like medication and bedding were getting trashed or stored at this warehouse and wasn't easily accessible. In March, the LA City Council passed a law that allowed homeless people to keep personal property on the street, as long as you can fit it all in just a trash can. The next morning, I was on my way back to Juanita's spot, and a few people were hurriedly cleaning up their areas. In front of her sidewalk was a police SUV. I saw Juanita's feet sticking out from behind a blue tarp, her back against the railing. She refused to clean up. She said she was sick of all the harassment.
You're not going to bully me around. You sit under the same laws that we do. You're not unreachable. You're not the law.
We made plans to go back to the warehouse again, but then I got this call.
Hey, Michael, this is Juanita. I did go to the hospital yesterday. Just wasn't feeling good, and so I'll still be here. So you know where to find me.
I went back a few times trying to find her. Her neighbor, Patty, told me that she hadn't seen her in a week. She suggested a few places I could look. I scanned the sidewalks. Hundreds of homeless men and women on every part. Tents lined up next to one another. The courtyards at the shelters just as full. Juanita would be nearly impossible to find.
So I just tried a couple more shelters. I left a name, but I don't know how much good that's going to do.
Suddenly, trip after trip downtown, Juanita was unreachable. I began to accept the fact that Juanita was just gone. And then my phone rang.
I'm getting my gallbladder taken out.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, but I'll be fine. I'm coming back.
Okay.
I just forgot to let you know that.
Juanita was in Phoenix. She said that healthcare was cheaper there, but she'd come back soon. I went down to find Juanita to help her finally move her stuff out of the warehouse. I was looking forward to seeing her. But when I got there, again, she was gone. I haven't heard from her since. More attempts to find her proved fruitless. And like a lot of people with homeless family or friends, I'm stuck wondering where she is, if she's okay. Can she even get in touch if she isn't? I hate the uncertainty of it all. But I can only imagine what it's like for Juanita. For Off-Ramp, I'm Michael Radcliffe.
A federal judge is asking the State Department to reconsider its decision to deny a passport to a Colorado resident who refused to check either male or female on the application. In a recent ruling, U.S. District Judge R. Brooke Jackson said he did not think the government had acted rationally in denying a passport to Dana Zim, who was born with ambiguous sexual characteristics and does not identify as either male or female. However, he said he wanted to give it a chance to reconsider, saying it was not time to weigh in yet on the constitutionality of the decision. Zim, a Navy veteran, praised the ruling but acknowledged it was the first step in a long battle. A handful of countries allows intersex people like Zim to designate their gender with a third option. We previously brought you an interview with Brooke Hauser, who wrote the biography Enter Helen, The Invention of Helen Gurley Brown and the Rise of the Modern Single Woman. Gurley Brown, author of the groundbreaking bestseller Sex and the Single Girl, took over an ailing Cosmopolitan magazine and revamped it, serving as its editor from 1965 to 1997. Hauser says Gurley Brown was a letter writer, and that included with Hillary Clinton and now President-elect Donald Trump.
Actually, I found a letter from Helen Gurley Brown to Trump, dated 1989, getting ready for Cosmo's 25th anniversary under her editorship, which would be in 1990. She wrote to Donald Trump asking him to pose nude for Cosmo's male nude centerfold, just like Burt Reynolds had done in the early 70s. And when I saw that, you know, I laughed out loud. She basically said that, you know, don't worry, Donald, like, we won't show anything. We'll be able to cover you up with a stack of books or a flower pot, something to that effect. And, you know, of course, he declined. But I just thought she really, she had some nerve asking him. And, you know, the way she sold it to him was that he was the top choice of her Cosmo girls. You know, they saw Donald Trump as being the ultimate cosmopolitan man because as she saw it and as they thought, he was smart, sexy, and successful. You know, this was back in the day when he was best known as a real estate tycoon. And I just have to wonder what she would make of him now. I can't imagine that she would support him now. She was so pro-choice. That was one of her passions throughout her career. You know, she marched for women's equality. She marched for reproductive rights, and she ran several articles in Cosmo over the years, starting really in the 60s, which was she was alone at that time writing articles about where to find an abortion provider, how to get an abortion, you know, and she really believed that women should be empowered with that knowledge. So to hear Donald Trump come out and say that women should be punished if they get abortions, I think she would have been horrified by that and by, you know, all the names that he's called women, dogs, disgusting animals, pigs. You know, I think that she would have been appalled.
The interview with Brooke Hauser about her book and Helen Gurley Brown is in 51% show number 1424. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1429.